The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Yes? Good? Sound? Okay. So I just came back yesterday from teaching a 7-day retreat at our retreat center in Santa Cruz, and I felt like I gave a lot of Dharma talks. So I'm not exactly in the mood of giving a talk. And so I think a nice thing to do periodically here is to hear your questions, take questions and try to respond. I think it's very useful for me to kind of hear what kind of questions you have and concerns you have. And I think it's also very helpful sometimes for you to hear other people's questions and what happens in the response. And also it's a little bit a way of hearing each other's voices and getting a sense of who comes here. So that's what my proposal is for today. Hopefully that's all right. If it isn't, we'll figure something else out. So anybody would like to start? Anybody would have a question they'd like to ask about practice or Buddhism or anything that seems related to what we do?
Okay, this is this on? Yeah. Is this better? Okay. Well, I'm not very good at talking, so I'm a little shy here, but you talked about equanimity, and I'm confused about it because it's portrayed as a you can achieve it, but it seems that we have our emotions and our reactions to things. That's an intelligence that we have about us, and that when we have that intelligence, we're able to. When we have those feelings. We can be mindful about it, and if we didn't have those feelings, and we were, you know, neutral, or you know, if we didn't have any reaction, so we were.
Good question.
Yeah.
It's a good question, and it's not. So I guess I gave a talk recently here about equanimity and. And one of the things I tried to be careful for was to distinguish it from things like indifference and aloofness and numbness and variety of things. But it is, from time to time, recognized as a very beautiful and very important quality. And sometimes it comes quite naturally to be equanimous if we understand the situation well. If we don't understand the situation well, then it's easy to maybe take it personally. And so the example I gave in my talk was the example of someone who's dying. And it's not an uncommon phenomenon that as people are dying in the deathbed, especially they're dying slowly and the chemicals and whatever is breaking down, that they start getting angry at sometimes the people they're closest to. And it's hospice caretakers will come to the family and commonly explain that this is something they might expect might happen. And so when it happens, they don't take it so personally. They don't take it, oh no, we're having a family crisis. They say, oh, this is part of this dying process and it's uncomfortable, it's not nice, but I don't have to take it as being the definition of a lifetime's relationship with my family member. And so there's a certain level of equanimity, which here means we don't take it personally. It doesn't cause us to get angry. It doesn't cause us to get afraid, which it might have been if we hadn't gotten that piece of advice. Make sense? The other example I gave was the difference between first-time parents and grandparents. Oh, the grandparents here just left. And, you know, first-time parents, everything is so amazingly meaningful, consequential, end of the world. But grandparents have been there before, and so they, you know, the kid says, "I hate you." You know, what if, you know, 3-4-year-old kids do that. So, you know, they're equanimous. It means they don't react to it. They stay balanced. And 5 minutes later, they say, "I want to marry you." Okay. I think in that kind of situation, equanimity means staying balanced, not getting caught in the reactions. Or I was on retreat many years ago, and someone started doing walking meditation in my walking lane. My walking lane. And so certainly I thought the person was going to enter my lane. Certainly the person would walk around me and walk somewhere else, just happened to be. So at some point I was walking away, and I turned around to walk back, and the person was not leaving. And so, since you talked about normal, natural, it's a relatively normal reaction that this is mine, to feel like, you know, to be angry at that. So it's relatively normal, okay? It doesn't have to be, but I got so anger arose. But I had a lot of equanimity about the anger. That's what it felt like. It was a lot of equanimity about my reaction. So the anger could well up. And that's what I did. It welled up, and it just kept going and disappearing into the ether. I call it Teflon mind. So there was a lot of equanimity about the anger, meaning I didn't buy into it, I didn't get reacted to it, I didn't get pushed around by it. The anger was allowed to be there, but there was like having a lot of space for the anger. It's kind of just, oh, just there, and I saw it, and it wasn't good or bad, I just, whew. So we would call that kind of mind an equanimous mind that allows the anger to bubble through without any kind of involvement with it. I didn't lose my balance of mind. So you could say that that is not natural, that really if I get angry, I should suffer. You know, I should get into it and allow it to really get involved. But Buddhist practice is meant to change us and change us in the direction so that we don't suffer. So that whatever the response is, whatever the things are happening in our life as they occur, that whatever the response and reaction we have is one that's free of suffering. And the quality of equanimity, as it gets really strong, is one that allows us to be in life in many, many circumstances without being triggered by it, without being caught up in what's happening, without getting what we call reactive to it. And by not being reactive, there's more space to respond in wise ways. So equanimity is a quality that supports that. Does that make sense? Or is that? Am I still missing you with the topic?
Yeah, I was just also thinking about
karma. Is a green light on?
Oh, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
For
everyone's sake, when you speak in the mic, two things. Good if you hold it horizontally. And the other thing is, listen for your voice, because you don't want to hear your normal... If you hear your normal voice, it's not working. If you hear kind of a little bit of a... If you hear yourself through the mic, then it's working for everyone.
Yeah, those examples you gave were really clear.
Yeah.
As trying to apply it to practical situations...
To what?
To practical situations,
yes,
that I encounter.
Oh, yeah.
Where I see could be some value in having an opportunity to enter into a conversation with someone and have some greater understanding based on acting or communicating rather than just having those feelings just sort of disappear
if I understand what you're saying, our responses, even our anger and our fear and all those things, it's best to take them as when they occur as useful pieces of information. We don't want to deny them if they occur. Because they are information, if not about the situation, about ourselves. But can we allow, if we have those responses, if we're angry or hurt or afraid, equanimity would allow us to have to be unafraid of those happening, or to be balanced as they happen, and so to be able to explain to someone else. When you said that, I felt really hurt. But the equanimity allows you to do that without going, boy, did you really piss me off? You know, I don't think saying you really pissed me off is a useful response. But it might be very useful to say, when you said X, I felt a lot of anger. So equanimity gives you that space to pull away enough so that when you say something, you're not attacking them. So, but it's important to know your anger sometimes, and sometimes you want to say it. But equanimity also gives you, and mindfulness also gives you the wisdom, hopefully, the chance for wisdom to operate, so you know when it's appropriate to tell someone that you're angry at them. You know, so in some situations, like, yes, you know, we had this conversation, and I experienced a lot of anger. You said X, and that was difficult for me, and I'm still angry from it. I wonder if we can talk about it. Might be the wise thing to say. The next time you see someone that pissed you off is at their best friend's funeral. You know, I need to talk to you. last time we were together. You know, I'm still having this anger, and you know, I think at the funeral of the best friend, I think you should have enough, hopefully enough balance and equanimity. This is not the time. So a wise life is one that is able to monitor ourselves and monitor what our reactions are and be balanced enough so that we can choose the time and place for stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. That's very good.
And then some equanimity happens because some equanimity has to do with equanimity about our reactions so we don't get caught by them. And some of the equanimity is we don't get our buttons pushed. And that's nice. You know, nice not to be. You know, if you have a lot of buttons that get easily pushed, you're really depend. Your happiness and well-being is dependent on all the people who might or might not push them. And you want to live a life where your well-being is dependent on what other people do. I don't think we want to do that. For mostly, I mean, there was a story I read many years ago of a doctor. I guess he was famous because it was just like, this was like, I don't know, 1820. A doctor in England who said, the next person who makes me angry will cause me to die. And sure enough, he had a heart attack. You know, so I think he recognized that he had such a strong problem with anger. It kind of welled up so strongly that it put a strain on his heart. Maybe. So, you know, his well-being was dependent on other people's actions. And we're not really free if our well-being is, or lack of well-being is completely tied up in what other people do. Yes?
The same talk about equanimity. More than halfway through, you started talking about tools, seven tools, and one of them was concentration. And I didn't really, I wasn't really clear on that. And if you could elaborate on that.
So I talked about seven different conditions that support equanimity. Because equanimity sometimes is not something you want to practice directly, but rather as a consequence of conditions we put in place. And so one of the conditions that can support equanimity is concentration, which is also synonymous, almost synonymous with becoming deep, becoming calm, tranquil. And so if you have a strength in your ability to focus, strength in your ability to be calm, then you're less likely to be triggered by things when they come along. If you're anxious, if you're harried, if you're kind of very agitated, it's a lot easier to be triggered by things around you. So if you can make yourself calm, people do that regularly. I think they breathe deeply, they kind of prepare themselves for difficult encounters, so when they come to the difficult encounter, they're not so easily tripped up by them or caught by them. So they're more balanced. Equanimity has sometimes something to do with being balanced. We enter into it with more balance, more ease, less reactivity. And so getting calm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The word concentration doesn't really say calm to me.
It doesn't say calm, yes.
It seems kind of like tight, like,
yeah.
like concentrate, like, you know, like a tight.
There's several people, a couple of people here at the retreat I just taught. And I gave a talk about samadhi, and I tried to avoid the C word, the concentration word, because many people have that, when they hear the word concentrate, have that association with it. It's kind of a narrowing, a tightening. You're up in the control tower and you're zeroing in. And the word samadhi, I prefer to translate it as composure. And a teeny bit I'm justified because the etymology of the words, the sum of samadhi is the same as the calm in English, the width. And the D part of samadhi means to pose or to stand, which is like to pose, right? Compose. And the reason that's a little bit etymological game, right? Composure. But more importantly, samadhi is a state. It's not a singular activity of the mind. Samadhi, which concentration maybe implies, it's a state of concentration or state of composure, state of collectedness or unification. And so it's something that is much more holistic than a simple functioning of the mind. So I appreciate that you don't like the word doesn't work for you, but I don't think we can avoid using the word because it's often used, concentration. But I think you might think of it when you hear someone teacher say it. You might try just translating in your mind to composure. In the back, can you pass the mic to the back row?
I think in the past I've heard you kind of create your world, your mind creates your world that you live in. And then on other times I've heard you are not your thoughts. So I'm trying to get a handle on that.
I think it's a little bit, maybe the tension between those statements has to do with the word "you're." So you have to look at that. What you mean by "you're" or the self? I don't know if maybe there's some Buddhists who say you create your world, but in our school of Buddhism, no one ever says that. We influence the world. We influence the world we live in by our actions. And so our actions, our attitudes, our intentions, our values, our integrity, our lack of all those can have a big impact on the world we live in. And so one place you can see an example of that, how you create the particular world that you live in is what it looks like inside your house. And some of you probably have very neat houses, and some of you have houses that, nothing to do with me, it was just nature. things evolved, it was natural event, and nature was moving through me, and it never occurred to me to do dishes for 2 weeks. It's just the dishes, not my doing. So we create the living environment we live in. Some people have greater influence on their wider environment. I've known people whose inside of their cars are rather embarrassing. So who's responsible? So in some ways we create things like that. Generally, when people make the claim we create our world, generally I think what they're saying is that I understand you're right, but that somehow the world that we perceive and experience through our world, so pretty much everything, is a product of our mind's creation. It's mind-made. And there are some Buddhist schools that say something like that, But our school doesn't say that, so we don't have to, we're not responsible to to answer those questions. But the other part that you are your thoughts. Is that what you said? Or you're not like your that. You're not your thoughts.
But you are.
You are your thoughts. Well, that's an interesting topic, our thoughts, and what's, you know, so you have to answer a number of issues come up around you are your thoughts. You know, how do you unconsciously define what you are? What do you relate to as being, this is who I am? In the 1800s, there was a great physicist, one of the fathers of laws of thermodynamics. Someone asked him, how did you come up with these brilliant laws of thermodynamics? And he said, something inside of me, which is not myself, came up with them. So he clearly identified it came from him. It wasn't like it didn't come from someone else. But he didn't feel like it came from that part of his brain, his mind, that he had like personal control over, or he identified, this is what my doing. His intuition, some deeper processing going on. So our thoughts... sometimes our thoughts are clearly something we choose to do. It's time for me to start thinking about, you know, all the important issues of the day and all the people I'm resentful for. And let me kind of get into it. Or we kind of somehow choose what we pay attention to. And sometimes we go and we just let our mind drift. And who knows what comes up. And it's not so intentional what we think about. My wife had a medically induced menopause for 3 months once in preparation for surgery. And she looked at me one day during that time and said, I'm having these thoughts, but these are not my thoughts. I mean, she wasn't saying they were someone else's thoughts, like they were being transmitted or something. But she didn't identify these thoughts that she was having as being her normal thoughts, who she was. She didn't feel responsible for them. In the normal way, because you know, they were just kind of bizarre to have these thoughts come up, and you know, conditioned by the changing hormones. So when thoughts, so where do our thoughts come from? Who's responsible for them? There's a fascinating study of thoughts that is confirmed by deep meditation, and that is. When they study, I guess, the brain, kind of do scanning of the brain, the mental activity of beginning to think happens before the person knows they're having a thought. And in deep meditation, you can sit very, very quiet and very still, and you can feel, different people experience it slightly different, but you can experience like the beginning of a bubble or pressure of thought arising in the brain, in the mind. And you can feel like it's like a bubble, like a rise. It's about to occur, the thought. So this feeling is about to occur, this thought. And then, but you can be, your mindfulness is right there to notice that you're doing that. And because you're right there, the thought just dissipates. That rising dissipates. And you'll never know what that thought was. And, you know, it probably was the great American novel and Missed a Chance. It's probably the answers to all your issues, but you know, who knows? But if thoughts begin in subconscious areas of the mind, kind of offline, are you responsible for them, or are you not responsible for them? You know, where do they come from? The Buddhist answer to that question is not. You're not responsible for what you think. In Buddhism, we're not so interested in the question, are you your thoughts or are you not your thoughts? As we are, when the thought arises and you're aware of it, your responsibility is not what you think. Your responsibility is what you do as a result. What do you do with those thoughts? So the thoughts arises and... And do you believe them? Do you act on them? Do you give them a lot of authority? Do you allow them to push you around? There's a lot of issues around that mindfulness helps you to look at about your relationship to a thought. Many people identify so strongly with their thoughts so that they really believe the thoughts are themselves. That's just who I am. And so the idea of not thinking is frightening, because everything about who they are and how they orient themselves in the world is based on their thinking. And so they're kind of afraid to let go of it. And in deeper meditation, as you get calm, thinking begins to dissipate, and people then start getting kind of afraid. Some people are so closely identified with their thinking that they think that everything they think is true. Because I thought it must be true. So it's possible to have mindfulness to be clear enough to not be so identified with it, the thoughts, and then to be able to question, is that really a true thought? Is that a true interpretation? Should I maybe I'll look more carefully rather than just assuming this is how it is? So the interesting question is how do we... our responsibility is not with the thought, but what we do as a result. So I don't know if this... I went on and on, I apologize, but... Is this okay?
So that thing that is thinking about your thoughts, what is that called?
Thinking about your thoughts? That's called thinking.
The entity. The entity that's thinking about the thoughts.
Why is that important to know?
I'm just curious.
Ah.
Is there a name for that thing?
What's your name?
Is that...
Over here. We have... Yeah. Is the green light on though? Okay. I guess.
Closer. Okay. I'll try to speak up. Non-violence. Right? I often hear non-violence when it comes to Buddhism and certain Hindu scriptures or yoga. But I would personally that might be something that's fairly easy to accept, right? Don't be harming the others. But for someone who's in the military, that's a very different reality, right? I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Why?
Because it seems to me that's not possible to have an awareness.
Well, not possible, you mean for an individual or for society? Because I mean, people in the military and the police are sanctioned, are requested. There's the request from our society is that these individuals keep us safe. And so, is it that these institutions cannot do without violence, or that individuals cannot do it? Because I've known people in the military and the police who had a very strong dedication to nonviolence, and that's why they were there. Actually. And some of them in the military didn't carry a gun. They were not in combat.
So, I don't mean any disrespect, but that sounds very sweet, right? It really does.
No, I don't think that's sweet at all. I know people who are medics in the military, and they chose to be medics because they couldn't fight. They were dedicated to nonviolence, but they wanted to help.
So, I'm
yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So this might be a horrible example, but it's a legitimate.
Right.
A person goes into a school and is shooting children.
Right.
Okay. So you're a law enforcement officer who decides you're not going to practice violence.
Right.
And what I'm hearing is you don't have your gun on you that day because you're going to practice nonviolence.
It's not what I said.
So I'd like to hear more about that.
But what I said was that not everyone in the military carries a gun. So I need to know what you're coming from, because and why I need to be the one who answers this question.
Well, I'm looking at it from a Buddhism perspective. You don't have to answer this question.
Right.
I'm looking for guidance, and that's why.
Ah, you're looking for guidance. So help me then. What is the particular issue you're dealing with? You're in the military? You have a personal... You're in law enforcement. Great. Thank you. Thank you for doing that. That's true. Helping the world. I think we own a lot of respect and appreciation for the intention to be in law enforcement. So thank you. And I prefer not to answer that question because it's such a tender and personal one. I think that I think what I prefer to in this kind of is to emphasize is a number of things. One is harm reduction, and to try to reduce the amount of harm we have. And there's a lot of creative ways and a lot of thought that can go into and care that can go into how do we reduce the amount of violence in our society. And not everyone thinks that way. I think sometimes people, I think in American culture, sometimes people are too quick to pull out the gun. And so, it's the easy solution. And so how do we as a society try to reduce the amount of violence rather than do black and white, you know, it has to be nonviolent. And I would hope that people who work in law enforcement are very active. It's a big responsibility and a kind of very important one. And how do we as a society support and help and be involved with law enforcement to try to reduce the amount of violence that everyone's involved in? I think that's my interest. When there should be violence, when there shouldn't be a violence, I think that is a judgment call of the people involved. If I'm involved in a situation where someone's being harmed, I'll have to wait until the situation exists to decide what to do. There have been some times in my life where I was put in harm's way, and one time where I was going to be beat up, and in that situation, I got down on one knee and opened my arms wide and said, I cannot fight. I'm pretty vulnerable, right? So that was a personal choice. And for me, it was the right choice to make. There was a story, I was teaching a retreat many years ago. The person turned around and left in disgust. So that was good. Harm reduction for everyone involved. I taught a retreat many years ago, and this woman came to on retreat and told her story from the civil rights time. And she was a white woman, had gone down to the South as a civil rights worker, and she had protested on a street corner with a group of people. And one day these, she described them as rednecks, kind of Ku Klux Klan guys, came in a pickup truck, jumped out, and started beating up the people on the sidewalk. And then they left. So the civil rights workers came back to the same street corners next day to do the protest again. The same guys came and beat them up. They stood on the sidewalk a third time, third day. So, you know, most people think that's silly, right? To do this, you know, put yourself in harm that way. You should at least fight back. But then the third day, the same people came, and she said to me, the guy was standing above me with his fist. He looked into my eyes. And when he looked into my eyes, he said to me, what in the world are you doing? And then they stopped and talked. And they had a conversation that they couldn't have had if they had fought back defending themselves. So what? And we know the civil rights movement was a dramatic time where people were willing and felt necessary to take abuse, physical abuse, for this greater good. It's not a strange thing to do because soldiers and police officers are willing to do that as well. That's why they have to take this job. They're willing in certain situations to put their life on the line in order to help other people. So people do that already, but to do it without the gun Some people decide that's worthwhile to do. It's good for the greater good. So, harm reduction. How can we reduce the amount of violence in our society, and how can we reduce the amount of violence that soldiers have to perform, that police officers are involved in? That's an interesting topic. That's something I can get my teeth around. The whole idea of what do we do in Sandy Hooks when someone's shooting all their kids up? We just wait until they're done? You know, that's kind of, you know, it's an extreme situation, but it's a very real one, right? That happened. It's a tragic situation. I think it's also tragic for the police officers. I mean, I don't know if you've known police officers or law enforcement people who've been involved in killing someone, had to because of their job. They need a lot of support. Sometimes some of them need a lot of support afterwards. It's not an easy thing. It's a big responsibility. So harm reduction. So you asked about Buddhism. I think there are some Indian religions like Hinduism and Jainism, and certain forms of Hinduism, Jainism in particular, that have very, very strong rules against nonviolence. Generally, Buddhism hasn't been so absolute about it. In fact, a couple of reasons for that. One is that generally in India, in the time of the Buddha didn't feel like it was his place to tell people, lay people, how they should live their lives. So he left them alone for them to make their own decisions that way. But for his monastic, his monks and nuns, they had very strong rules of nonviolence. They were so strong that they were supposed to let themselves die if someone, you know, they weren't supposed to, you know, fight back in the normal and usual way we think. So that's pretty dramatic. But that had its own context for it of their own religious life. But even there was an exception allowed. And that is that if a monk or nun is being attacked, and back then it was mostly, you know, weapons and fists, right? I mean, swords and stuff. They said the monk is allowed to strike out for the purposes of escape. In order to get away, they can strike out. Like the knife, you know, someone's going to hit them and they can push the hand away or push the person away. But with a caveat. They have to do it with no hate in their hearts. So that's a whole turn your concern upside down on you, turn it back on you, maybe. I hope it's okay, and that if you're involved in needing to use violence to protect people. But maybe that might be hard. Though sometimes that's needed, right? That's what's really required. I've been impressed by some of the law officers that I've seen, how at least professionally, how they're able to keep a very strong level of equanimity. It's quite impressive. I think probably necessary. But my hope is that, yes, but to do it without any hate, even for the person that you have to shoot or something. So that's a kind of teaching that comes from Buddhism that I think I'd like to emphasize. So, one more? Yes, one more? Over here, we have the mic back over here. Here, it's coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Are you listening?
Thank you. It's my first time here.
Welcome.
My question is in relation to deadlines in the future, goals and deadlines, tasks to do in the future.
Yes.
And the anxious that it can produce
anxiety,
in the present.
Yes, yeah.
So how, for example, in my life, can I be focused in the present, doing what I need to do, to a deadline that is in the future and that produces anxious? So in the present, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do because I'm anxious with the future. No. So this is basically what I would like to ask.
That sounds painful. So what occurs to me to say has to do with a principle that's expressed a little saying. And that is, you don't dig a well when the house is on fire. So you should dig the well when before the fire, have it ready. And then when the fire comes, you have the water, right? So I don't know what you're going to do about your anxiety right now, but if you cultivate mindfulness, do meditation practice, it'll, and then in your meditation practice, learn to look more deeply into your anxiety and learn how to be calm in the midst of your anxiety. Learn to be calm in the midst of your life more, that you might begin having the skills, the understanding, to be able to not be caught by the anxiety, they're caught by the future thinking, so you can take care of what's here. So it's not a direct answer, like, do this and you'll be fine. But I think it's a matter of slowly developing yourself and cultivating the ability, the mindfulness, so that your mind is strong enough that you become free of those things. Okay? So thank you for all that. I appreciate hearing your concerns and where you're all coming from, and I think it's important for you to have a chance to speak and speak up and me to hear what the concerns are. And I hope my answers and responses were respectful of what you said. And it was interesting for me to hear that my talk in equanimity had repercussions. Yes, I take that as a good sign. I think people are thoughtful about it. So, thank you. I wish you all a thankful week.